Thanks for selling your car to Carvana. Here's your check.
Whoa, when did I get here?
What do you mean?
I swear it was just moments ago that I accepted a great offer from Carvana online. I must have time traveled to the future.
It was just moments ago. We do same day pickup. Here's your check for that great offer.
It is the future.
It's the present and just the convenience of Carvana. Sorry to blow your mind.
It's all good. It happens all the time.
Sell your car the convenient way to
Carvana.
Pickup times may vary and fees may apply.
This podcast is supported by Talkspace.
When my husband came home from his military deployment, readjusting was hard for all of us. Thankfully, I found Talkspace.
Talkspace provides professional support from licensed therapists and psychiatric providers online. Military members, veterans, and their dependents ages 13 and older can get fast access to providers, all from the privacy of their computers or smartphones.
I just answered a few questions online, and Talkspace matched me with a therapist. We meet when it's convenient for me, and I can message her anytime. It was so easy to set up, and they accept TRICARE. Therapy was going so well, my husband and I started seeing a couples therapist through Talkspace, too.
Talkspace works with most major insurers, including TRICARE. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com/military. Go to Talkspace.com/military to get started today. That's Talkspace.com/military.
Hey everybody, welcome back to the Grey Malkin Lane podcast, where queer friends and allies gather to review and discuss the original X-Men comics in continuity order. The Silver Age is almost over on Grey Malkin Lane. We're jumping into new format, new stuff in the new year. But you know, I was coming up on the end of the year, realized there's just a couple of issues we never got to. One of them is one of my very favorite series of all time. We're going to be covering Marvel's number 2 today. This is a second issue of a 4-issue limited series from 1990. It's gorgeous. It's so smart. It's so well done. And this is a story called Monsters. We're going to talk all about it today. First, though, I am thrilled to be welcoming 3 real-life friends that I've got to meet in real life and hang out with this year to the show. 2 of you for the first time. Welcome to Grey Malkin Lane. Let me have you introduce yourselves with your name and pronouns. Tell us a little bit about yourself. And my intro question today is, who's your favorite civilian character in the X-Men? Who's that, like, non-powered character that you're extraordinarily fond of in the way that I'm fond of Candy Southern and Fred Duncan? So let me first welcome the incredible Tyson Leitz to the show. Hi, Tyson.
Hi there. How's it going? Thanks for having me. My name is Tyson Leitz. I am first and foremost a chef and actor. I cosplay. I do a lot of volunteer work in and around the Twin Cities area, which is where I call my home. And just an all-around nerd. Anything comics and pop culture, I am on board and love to absorb. But happy to be here and excited to talk about one of my favorite Alex Ross runs.
And who's your favorite supporting character in the X-Men?
Supporting character? Oh boy, that's a hard one. I'm not as well versed with X-Men, so I don't really know that I have any that are not powered.
You have like one of the characters' love interests or something. Sometimes that narrows the category down a little bit.
Yeah, I'm not even gonna lie. I can't think of anybody that doesn't have powers. Everybody that I think of, I'm like, yeah, that's a mutant, or they're super powered in some way.
Tyson is well connected with some of our dear friends from the show, Chandler, Dylan, Regina, and others. I feel like Tyson and Chandler are like the two dads of the Uncanny Experience. They're both running around, keeping everything going.
too kind. I'm happy to be the father.
It's great to see you, man. Let me also welcome my friend Derek Nichols to the show. Hi, Derek.
Hey, everybody. My name is Derek Nichols. My pronouns are he and they. I'm just kind of new to this community here, so I appreciate getting to know you all, and nice meeting you, Tyson, since after the first time today. I think my favorite, does Brian Braddock count, right?
No way.
No? Does it count?
All right. What? He's not a mutant.
He's got a flight suit. That's not a supporting character.
Okay. Oh, fair. Okay, so how about Opal Tanaka? So I think I read one of the first, where Jean and Bobby were having that conversation in the bookstore, like that. I think she was part of that. So she stood out for me.
Making the Opal Tanaka Patreon episode with Justin Park, one of my favorites from that batch of single character reviews. Such a delightful time. Let me also welcome the wonderful Seth Martell to the show. Seth, I fucking talk about you like every week, but welcome back. It's always a joy to have you here.
Yikes. Hi, everybody. I am Seth Ahiem. I guess you know me from chat talking about me, but I wrote a graphic novel called The Mayor, out from Graphic Mundi, and I do a lot of art for this show, or you can see some of my art on my Instagram. My favorite supporting cast member would not be the Dunk, as I think Chad would like me to say, but actually it's Stevie Hunter. She's phenomenal. She's interesting. She is incredibly important to the comic books and has been around for generations. And I love that she has become, was it a congresswoman? Or
she's a congresswoman now.
Yeah, that's phenomenal. I mean, I just think it's such an amazing evolution for who she was and like all the places that she, you know, represented that amazing bridge between humans and mutants, but, you know, her empathy and, you know, just being wise when Kitty Pryde was a teenager. I just think she's a great, great character.
There are so many supporting characters. Haven't got to all of them on my character episodes, but we do have a Stevie Hunter episode planned for February for the Patreon. So I'm in the middle of my Stevie Hunter research. I've always loved her. I still love her. She's incredible. Lastly, I'm Chad Anderson. I use he, him pronouns. I love the supporting characters. I love the non-powered weirdos that are kind of off to the side. I love like the 60s chicks that get like revamped and re-understood as the years go by. I like it especially when we get a lot of character development. If I say a character name that's non-powered, it's going to bring up a particular emotion. Feel free to say pass if you don't know any of these characters. But Derek, if I say the name Annie Gazakanian, what comes to mind?
You just made me laugh. a lot comes to mind. I can almost sympathize with her in some ways because, okay, through a gay lens, like we've all crushed on somebody that couldn't reciprocate. And she was, you know, crushing on Havoc, but kind of was reciprocating. Convoluted not to go down that rabbit hole, but like at the beginning of that, I kind of feel for her and like wanting to love somebody who you didn't know what could love you back.
So. Yeah, you know, single mom of a mutant kid making out with Havoc one minute, Iceman the next, while slut shaming Stacey X and Husk. You know, there's a lot going on for this lady.
Okay, maybe not all of that. I can sympathize with.
It was a weird time.
Seth, if I toss the name Lee Forrester at you, what comes to mind?
Oh, man. She dated Cyclops and was on that weird island. And
the only character I know of that has fucked both Magneto and Cyclops.
Yeah. I mean, she makes some choices. But, you know, I really don't know what she's... What does she do now? Where'd she go?
She's around. She's living in the Bermuda Triangle with the Skull the Slayer. I need to do a Patreon on her one day, too. She's a pirate lady. We love a strong, powerful woman in our comics. If I toss the name Mariko Yashida at you.
No, Mariko. Was that a love interest of Wolverine?
Yeah, Wolverine almost married her. Almost.
So now, and correct me if I'm wrong, which I almost certainly am. Did they not have a child in a run?
I think you're thinking of Dawkin, who is the child of a different love interest of Wolverine, perhaps.
Yeah, and he has the claws that come out of his wrist. Yeah. That's exactly who I was thinking about. And then Sabretooth ends up murdering him and all that kind of thing.
Yes.
Yeah. So wonderful.
Oh, he's back. Now he's a ghost writer.
Oh, I love it. Yay. I have so much to catch up. My goodness. I would say just such a tragic human being to have been. If there is one continuous trope that Wolverine always has, it's that anybody that Wolverine loves dies. Poor young woman.
Wolverine and Daredevil. It's just a quick casualty every time. Maybe Batman. For long-term listeners, you could name a lot of your own favorites. Trish Tilby, Valerie Cooper. We can toss a lot of names your way. Gabrielle Haller, Charlotte Jones, Candy Southern, Vera Cantor. There's a lot of different characters that are just kind of waiting to be explored. We love a character that gives us perspective. We talk frequently on the show about how one of the ways to make the world of mutants really compelling is by giving us that POV character, right? Mm. At different points in time, that's Jubilee or Kitty Pryde, when we take the young character and put them in that hero space. But there's a lot of ways to tell a superhero story. Kurt Busiek is someone who's amazing at telling it from the civilian perspective. He has a long run on a book called Astro City, which is really fascinating. It tells superhero stories from a lot of different lenses. Are any of you familiar with Astro City? It's quite compelling. It's a different universe, obviously, but it's really, really good. And Alex Ross, as a companion on this book, has a way of making superheroes not look like cartoony superheroes, but more like a real person dressed up in superhero clothes, right? Mm-hmm. You know, you can make Clark Kent look one way and Superman look the other, but Alex Ross has a way of making Superman kind of look like Clark Kent. There's a way of making this book that we're about to review feel like really grounded good and really incredible. Seth, how would you describe Alex Ross's style of art?
I mean, it's photorealistic watercolor. It's gorgeous. You said everybody looks like a human that has distinctive, consistent facial characteristics. He's really hard worker. He's incredibly talented.
Tyson, do you have opinions on Alex Ross?
Absolutely. I mean, Alex Ross is arguably one of my favorite comic book illustrators, bar none. His work, the first time that I was introduced with Alex Ross was reading Kingdom Come, so a DC run, and immediately feeling as though I wasn't looking at a comic book anymore. I was looking at a book of fine art. So his ability to take these characters and these worlds that we know and turn them into something that I would easily accept on the wall of any fine art gallery or museum is impeccable. And the fact that he's able to pump these books out, these 40 plus long page books out monthly, and they're all painted, is truly amazing.
So. Yeah. And with a cast of characters as big as this, right? Mm-hmm. We have a group chat running during this. Derek just pointed out, we missed it all girls. Think of the male supporting characters. They're often characters that are, in X-Men at least, that are less used or they're quite evil, right? We've got characters like Bolivar Trask and Cameron Hodge, but they always turn out to be like really awful. We do have occasional love interests for characters, but they're often not as used. Yeah, Harry from Harry's Hideaway, Fred Duncan, Bernard the Poet, I'll show up on this list. That guy that Jean dated in the Silver Age for a minute. You know, we've got characters like Tom Corsi and Sharon Friedlander. Like, we can expand the list, but often it's not the guys in the X-Men, at least, that get those supporting roles. Although there's certainly a lot in individual series along the way. The book I think that is best known for its incredible supporting cast is Amazing Spider-Man, where you could list about 30 characters that get a lot of room, but you know, the main ones, Aunt May and Mary Jane and Gwen Stacy and Harry Osborn. We start jumping into J. Jonah Jameson and Randy Robertson, and that have a lot of stories, and they all kind of get mixed in with superhero stuff because that's the way New York City works in the Marvel Universe, right? But for the X-Men, a lot of the stories are very focused just on the mutants. And I think that's very different. When we look at Silver Age books alone, Incredible Hulk number one is the Hulk or Bruce Banner rushing in to save a teenager playing a harmonica from a pit, right? We have Rick Jones, who's like the ultimate supporting character right there. Spider-Man's Uncle Ben dies in that first issue. Daredevil has Foggy Nelson and Karen Page, and Thor has Nurse Jane Foster through which to see the wonders of Asgard. You know, we could run down the whole list, but in X-Men number one, there is not really any supporting characters. The Avengers, of course, give us Edwin Jarvis all the time, who's like always that everyman. But there's never quite that supporting cast in the same way in individual X-Men books. Even when you look at the solo books that we love, Wolverine doesn't even really have a huge supporting cast of human characters. It's kind of the X-Men in their own world.
There's so many characters, I think, in X-Men that we have enough perspectives, right? There's enough variations in thoughts where the few times that we do get the external person, it's exciting and different. But, you know, the other books are solo books, so you really are trying to reflect the character then. You know, you're trying to get, like, build a world around them.
Even for X-Men supporting families, we don't see a lot of their parents used very much. Corsair is the only one that's prominently used, but a lot of the characters, we don't know who their parents are or know very little about them. Even when there's characters like Sarah Gray, Jean Grey's sister, who's just never had much explored, there's a lot of interesting room to explore. These are the types of stories I want to write more than anything, is like, where do characters come from?
They're just there to murder. That's it.
I'm in the middle of my Thunderbird research, and like the whole tribe gets wiped out in one issue, and you know, suddenly Warpath has something to be on the Warpath about, but we never get a lot of reason to care about these side characters. Now, Marvel's is a book that really takes everything from the side, where we look at the world of superheroes from the lens of these everyman characters. I would describe my own writing style as most akin to Kurt Busiek. Kurt has a way of lining up everything in the Marvel universe and realizing this is a shared universe. The issue we're about to read really celebrates the wedding of Mr. Fantastic and the Invisible Girl, right? Which was Marvel's kind of first big crossover event back in the 1960s. In that special where they get married, a lot of the other characters show up. All the other heroes are fighting villains outside because Dr. Doom charged up an emotion charger and made all the villains attack. And so all the superheroes are outside, right? The Avengers are punching Mole Man outside the wedding. And the X-Men are fighting, you know, Porcupine or whoever. But before that, in Marvel, Marvel's issue number one, if we go back to the 1940s, kind of the first big crossover event was the Human Torch, the original one, fighting the Submariner in New York City, which wasn't a huge event, but it was two of their characters mixing stories for the first time. So this is something that Marvel's really works hard to do. They look at all the books that are being published. They look through what's happening in various publication dates. And you have to, number one, line up where what is happening with what. Because, you know, New York can't be getting hit with a tidal wave at the same time that Adhesive X is being dropped all over the streets. Mm-hmm. We'll talk about both of those today. And number two, you also have to be able to work in the retcons. Like, oh, who was that character in the background that we didn't know about originally? Mm-hmm. Now, Marvel's is beloved. I'm going to assume all of you have read this beforehand. And when I invited you to this episode, you didn't even know we were doing Marvel's. What was your opinion on Marvel's when you first read it?
Satisfied, because it wove all these pieces together in one fantastic mm-hmm. story, and just merging different parts of the Marvel universe at that time. You know, it's a fan's kind of like a love letter to the fans, I guess, in a way. Mm-hmm. Even like the art, the cameos that you see in the background, they still make you, it makes you really engrossed in story.
I love Easter eggs. When you see the movie and you see that text on the screen that refers back to that thing that only you know because you're the nerd, this book is full of Easter eggs. It's it's the handbook guy's favorite, right? I love a book mm-hmm. that makes you think like this. And Marvel has a number of these books, often under this kind of lens of the Marvels. But this book was a huge production in a way that like the official handbooks back in the 80s were a huge production.
Yeah. So I read this the first time that I picked up Marvels. This was I borrowed it from a friend. They had all the trades and it was probably 2001-ish. So it had been out for quite some time. Marvels, this run was one of my first steps into Marvel comics in general. I grew up a DC kid and immediately was really hooked in by how rich the world feels. And it's amazing how much, and we're talking about Easter eggs, how much you can pack into four books. And they're not incredibly enormous books either. I mean, we're talking about fairly standard sized books. One of the super fun things that I noticed upon reading it just a couple years ago, because I'll pick this back up every couple of years, is that I never noticed, but during the gala, when they are at the art show with all the sculptures and everything, there's a moment where you can see Stephen Strange in the background, and it's never alluded to that it is Stephen. We never see his name in any text bubble or anything like that. But when you look at this man in the background, it is so obviously Stephen Strange. And I feel like the more and more I read this particular run, the more and more little things I find in the background like Stephen. And it's just one page. It's one little panel, and then you never see him again. But sure enough, there he is. The richness and the incredibly sort of full feeling that this book has really pushed me into the rest of the world, because I wanted to learn more about these people.
You don't know how intentional all this is. Sometimes things play out without this intention, but the key focal character in this book is a guy named Phil Sheldon, who is a cameraman. And the very simple eye of this is a guy looking through a lens, right? Wherever that lens is focused is where we look at the spectacle that's in front of us. Mm-hmm. If we turn it away from the action of Galactus over the city, what do we notice about the civilians who are in the car on the corner, you know? Mm-hmm. But you never get to follow that lens unless it's pointed. Marvel's has a couple of follow-up series. One of them is literally called Marvel's The Eye of the Camera, and another is Marvel's Epilogue. And they're both incredible. There's also the Marvel's Project. There's several versions of these books. Busiek has written more of this stuff. Against the Astro City, and if you want more of Alex Ross around this time, go look at the DC book Kingdom Come, which is really, really incredible. The last thing I wanted to introduce here very quickly is the sliding timescale. So for those of you who are just listening to this now, we have just released recently the Trial of Franklin Richards, where Tom Brevoort's one of my guests. We talk a lot about the concept of the sliding timescale, and we almost proposed the theory of Franklin Richards once he's born, which is not at this point. Everybody in that kind of superhero sphere, he is slowing their age down almost in a subconscious way. This idea that all of the superhero characters, the ones that the camera lens is pointed at, they age slowly over time. 60 years have passed, 80 years have passed, but the characters have only aged, you know, 10 or 15 years. But the characters around them and the world around them is still still changing at the same speed. The presidents are always in and out. So where 15 years is passing for us, 1 year is passing for them. It's this kind of odd idea. Now, Phil Sheldon kind of gives us that perspective. And we see series that explore this every once in a while. Phil Sheldon, as you read Marvels, is aging in every issue. He's getting older as time goes by. And that sliding time scale, we see books here that are set in the 40s, then the 60s. Issue number four ends around 1974, which is right where my show's at. And this is what makes this conversation kind of delicious as we launch into this new era where things get more complex. But Sheldon ages in real time. And that idea of the shared universe and the complexity of the sliding time scale as we introduce it, I think is really interesting. We're going to talk about Marvel's number two specifically, again, which is a story called Monsters. But if you go back and read Marvel's number one, this is where we meet Phil Sheldon back in the 1940s when America felt really innocent, I suppose, in a way, in the post-World War II years. The industrial age is expanding and the baby boomer generation is like really living their dreams. Rock and roll is happening. It's a world right before McCarthyism, right before moon launches and atomic radiation and bombs hit in very real ways. And Phil Sheldon is dating his high school sweetheart, Doris Jacquette, and they start crossing paths with people like Jim Hammond, the Human Torch, who's an android who lights on fire, and Namor the Submariner. And the idea of the spectacle of these heroes from other worlds and what they represent. The issue gets really big. If you get toward the end, there's this giant splash page of a tidal wave washing over the city. And Phil Sheldon ends up losing an eye in this. And so when we meet him in issue two, he's older, he's got an eye patch now, and he's still holding the camera. So he literally only has one eye to look through. The parallel between him and Cyclops is something we'll talk about in a minute. But think about that myopic vision, the direction that we look in. We also see, and the first issue closes with a giant image of superheroes from World War II parachuting down on a Nazi castle. It's really beautiful. And then we open issue two, where the world has gotten a little bit more complicated. It's years later. Phil is now married to Doris. They have two daughters, and he's trying to sell a book. He's got a big idea. And we have this kind of backdrop of this family man going into the city to try to find his way in the craziness of the balance of all the superheroes happening around them. Seth, tell us about the cover of Marvel's number two. This is fucking iconic. It's gorgeous.
Yeah, I mean, it's really beautiful. It's incredibly smart. Was it, did you buy this on the newsstand, Chad? Do you remember? Was this, did it have a plastic wrapper around it? Like a plastic, like I feel like the Marvels was printed in like, as like on black ink on clear plastic, and that covered this. So it wasn't actually, like, I feel like the image itself didn't have the Marvels printed on it. It was just on its own. I don't know if I'm imagining that, but that's my little kid remembering of buying it. And I think it was expensive. I think it was expensive too. Like, I think this cost me like, you know, a lot out of my allowance to buy. But it was just absolutely beautiful on the rack at Iron Vic's when I bought it back when I was a kid. It's just a stunning book to see something that is watercolor, and it hits all the right notes of nostalgia in how the fit of the uniform is like roomy and you know, very 1960s and looks like real fabric. And I love everything about that. And every face that's looking up at him are just, you know, incredibly expressive, beautiful faces with this angelic, beautiful mutant holding a very sad small girl who is just, you know, you have full of sympathy for the way that she looks because she is just a tiny, emaciated, little, different looking person. And he's beautiful, like Angel has always been, but he's a mutant just like her. And there's signs that say Satan's children and devils as they're holding it up towards an angel, which is just really great, great framing for it all.
The civilians very much capture like 1960s energy. The men are in ties, the women have, you know, glasses and bouffants and pearl necklaces. But they're full of hate, right? They're tossing things in the air, and it's almost messianic. It's almost like Jesus saved the little children energy. Angel is ascending in the sky toward the light coming down through the Marvels title. And this girl looks like just a normal little girl, but it's a very horror movie thing where she's very emaciated. She's withered. She's got pigtails and bows and a pink dress, but she's got a very pink, gaunt, almost kind of starvation looking face with these huge black eyes. And there's an innocence, but an eeriness about her. And people give themselves permission to be violent toward all of this. Again, we're at a post-McCarthyism atomic age as the book starts here. It's a beautiful, beautiful book. And anytime we're capturing Angel with, he's either the Messiah or the Destroyer, right? He's the metal-winged flaming sword guy, or he's the feathered-winged flying into space guy. Go back and see the Angel trial. We talk all about all of this. As we jump into the book, we jump not to the Daily Bugle, but to the book across the street, the Daily Globe. This is a book from early Spider-Man. Spider-Man. If you go back and read Amazing Spider-Man 27, we meet Barney Bushkin, who is the director of the Globe. And that's the guy that's working with Phil Sheldon here. Sheldon is trying to sell his book. And as he's in the middle of all this, there's superhero action happening on the streets outside. And the office is kind of in a hubbub. Everybody is focusing. They're all rushing to see if they can catch a sight of any superheroes storming by. We open with Phil Sheldon saying, it wasn't that long ago, but it was a different time. There was so much energy in New York as if fireworks had been going off for months. The birth of the Fantastic Four, Thor, Giant Man, the return of the Submariner, and of course, the biggest blast of all, showstopper that lit up the world like a dozen 4th of Julys rolled into one. We flip the page and Tyson, who do we see?
We're looking at Captain America leaping over cars on his way to rescue someone.
And Cap, how does he, tell us how Alex Ross paints Cap. It's
totally. So you're looking at the original design of him, right? When we look at the detail that Alex Ross has put into here, his use of light is on display in full form. The individual, technically chainmail is what they write, but it's more of like a scaled mail. You can see each individual scale on Cap's uniform. There are creases where he is sort of crouched over in his midsection and his abdominal. So again, that display of real fabric, it looking as though this man has sewn his costume together as opposed to it being fabricated out of rubber and metal and steel and all these new kind of Marvel tropes that we see with all these lines. The giant A on his forehead is iconic and something that we lose shortly after this design. It is Captain America as I remember him from when I was a little boy. It's endlessly nostalgic.
This image, it gives us, and we're not going to spend time here, but it gives us Make America Great Again in a way that we kind of understand, because Cap is the American dream, right? He's the weakling who was in the right place at the right time and gave all to his country and served in the war, and he died, he was gone, and now he's out. He's out of the iceberg and everyone is freaking out. They're so fucking excited to see their hero. Phil's got his camera out just to catch a glimpse of him, always in motion, always moving forward like a force of nature in chainmail. Never a hesitation or a backward glance. We were in awe of him, of all of them. And even when we were scared, when lives were threatened, we knew they'd come through for us, that they'd make everything all right again. Like I said, it was a different time. Think of the trust in the government, the trust in the superhero, right? So we get an image of the Black Knight, the original one, not Dane Whitman. This is his uncle Nathan, who is got like chainmail on, and he's riding around on a winged black horse and dropping something called Adhesive X over the city. This is a story from Avengers number 6, I believe, where Baron Zemo is also back. It's not just Cap, it's Baron Zemo. Heinrich Zemo is a World War II Nazi guy who, when he created Adhesive X, it got stuck to his face, and the pink mask he wore gets stuck to his face too. Now he's dropping it all over the city, and the Avengers are fighting off the Masters of Evil. One of them, who is a communist agent named the Radioactive Man, he's a Chinese guy spraying literally radioactivity along with Adhesive X all over the city. Mm. We get these images of the Avengers, the ones we love and expect, the white incredible superheroes. Thor, who's the white god, like Aryan god almost. Iron Man, who's the great weapons maker. And then we get this iconic image, and if I thought of Marvels, this is the one image that stands out above all others, of Phil Sheldon capturing an image of Giant Man stepping over the city. Derek, tell us about this page.
Oh, it's beautiful. I mean, it's always great. It just makes you feel small because you're actually in the perspective of Phil. You're literally in between Giant Man's legs, staring up at his crotch, which also makes me think about a lot of other things too at this time and how real that could possibly be. But it's just imposing, and it looks, even the look on Hank's face, like, looks determined and just looks like that classic superhero.
It's really, really beautiful. And I remember seeing this on the cover. There's something just fucking magic about it. The giant man, right? Like, Hank Pym is flawed and messy, but it's the giant man. We jump back over to the Daily Globe offices, and this is where there's lots of Easter eggs. There's a sign on the wall that says Santa Rico, country in crisis. This is a literal one-shot story from like the Ant-Man series that was happening, where Ant-Man and the Wasp go fight a guy named El Toro in a South American country called Santa Rico. So this book is full of little Easter eggs. I won't point all of them out, but it's really, really fun to see them. Phil's an excellent photographer. He wants to sell his book. He wants to write his own book. And he thinks that he has a deal with a place called Empire Books. This is a new company for this series. We look outside, and Johnny Storm is doing that infamous
four on fire over the city to summon all of the Fantastic Four. Really beautiful. And Phil Sheldon is going home with ideas about writing a book in his brain. He is doing it. He's living the American dream, right? He's there to sell his big idea. He gets to do the thing nobody else can. He's thinking, a book? I was going to write a book. How would it start? Hercules and Gilgamesh, Roland and King Arthur, the names of legend, but the legends are being outshone in the form of, nah, too highbrow. Colorful costumes, peculiar names, astounding powers, put them together and, nah, too corny. My first thought was it might be a story, that I should get some pictures. I thought it might be some purse snatchers, but the crowd wasn't just angry, they were frightened. So as he steps outside, another huge Easter egg, and this is from another book happening. The Wasp is putting her clothing line up. She's a fashion designer in the local windows. Seth, you want to tell us about the Wasp's fashion designs circa 1960?
I mean, it was a huge part of her character back then. She designed all the uniforms for all the Avengers. Like, it was just a big thing that I love that they included it here, because it just grounds every little piece of Marvel history into it, and it makes them feel like they surround the world. You know, she's such she's a big part of it. Like, he's, you know, her husband's up in the air. She's in the stores. I mean, they're just everywhere, permeating these people's lives in New York City. You know, you can't get away from them.
The 18-year-old girl sidekick to the guy twice her age, who's the, you know, superhero turned giant guy, ant guy. Complicated. I'll do the trial of Janet Van Dyne on my show one day. I promise. I love her very much, but it'll be a while. Now, as we see Phil going outside, he sees a crowd. People have spread the word and they are very upset. Now, the only place I can find reference to this directly, and this doesn't directly parallel the story, if you go back to X-Men Volume 1, Number 2, there's a scene with some construction workers and some people throwing bricks. But there are scenes in the early Silver Age where characters are getting, you know, chased around. Beast in Number 8, for example, saves a little boy and a crowd turns against him, which is what inspires him to quit the X-Men for a period of time. Cue the time travel adventure by Brian Michael Bendis. We don't need to go there today. So as they're going outside, Phil hears like someone, a group of heroes has attacked a construction worker. They attack him just for the thrill of it. Somebody's got to do something. They knocked him off right off the scaffolding somehow, but that wasn't enough for him. They tried to blast him to bits. They clawed at him. They tried to smash him into the wall. And we see images, blurs of the X-Men in action as it looks like they're attacking an innocent civilian. And now everyone is up in arms. He's still alive, but we're going to show him they can't mess with real humans. Now, Phil in his thoughts says, I heard later someone said they weren't trying to kill the man, but save him after he fell. But that didn't make any sense. They wanted us all dead. Everybody knew that. And we get this image where the crowd turns the corner. It's red and black, and we get a very frightening view of the original X-Men, the strangest teens of all, as they were labeled in the 60s. Derek, tell us about this image and the energy it captures.
It's terrifying. If you did not know anything about the X-Men, you would definitely think that these were villains. Like, they're all dead. And even the image is right beforehand, leading up to like how the bystanders are describing what this group of people were doing to the construction worker. It looks like they really are attacking, but knowing that you can see Bobby's doing his ice slide thing. He's trying to save the guy, knowing that, you know, again, if you're familiar with the X-Men world, you know that they're not trying to attack. They're trying to save or prevent him from getting hurt. But the image itself is all red. And in contrast to the image that you just asked us to talk about Hank Pym, like, he's in a blue sky, bright, cheery, and this is just red, menacing.
The idea of crowd fervor, right? Groupthink. We see some heroes in brightly colored costumes being absolutely celebrated. People are cheering about these superpowered creatures fighting villains in their city. But we turn the page, and the idea of, like, this simple man is being attacked. They're responding to these characters in a way that they did not respond to the radioactive man and the Black Knight on the previous pages. What do you think it is? Why do we turn toward one thing with such fervor and another thing with such fear? And I love that Marvel's takes us there at the very second issue, because Kurt Busiek is a huge Silver Age X-Men nerd, I know, but he loves everything more. Capturing the dichotomy of this, he's doing it in a way that wasn't really present in the 60s. Like, it's bigger here than we ever saw really in the Silver Age books. Tyson, did you have thoughts on that? The shifting fervor from adoration to fear?
Absolutely. I think that, so when we think about the vast majority of superheroes, whether we're talking Marvel, DC, Dark Horse, any comic book company, these are typically people that have gained their power and have have been given power through some happenstance, something happened to them, or it's an accident, or whatever it may be, that gave them their powers, right? Steve made the decision to sit in that chair and become Captain America. He sacrificed himself through this. So these are human beings that are taking on a mantle for the betterment of us. Whereas the mutants are born like this. They are, especially in this run, seen as the next evolution, right? They are the best part of humanity and what we are going to become, leaving us, the Homo sapiens, inadequate or not needed anymore. So the moment that we as human beings are challenged and that our safety or our well-being or our self-worth are challenged, what do we usually do? Lash out. So these are not, to them, human, like, say, a Lantern, or again, Captain America or Tony Stark are. They are the other. And it's easy to put them in that box.
The other ones are doing it in broad daylight, right? It's the light of day is shining on them. The X-Men are in the alley. The alley tried to save people. They're not doing the big public display, at least at this point. To put this in a modern lens, we have people still kind of shrugging of, well, yeah, he hit his wife, but he had a bad day at work. He didn't mean it. He flirted with the teenage girl, but all guys do that. Where on the flip side, it's you chose to be gay. You chose to be trans. Now you're putting my children at risk. We can capture this so easily when we apply even modern lenses to this, and it's almost right. So Phil, who's a really good guy, he's a genuinely nice human. He's a good family man, and he's like celebrating superheroes. Suddenly he's got his camera out. He snaps a shot of these X-Men kind of bathed in Cyclops' red light because his visor is glowing. The X-Men, I'd never seen them before, but I'd heard of them. Superpowered mutants, freaks. They look just like normal people, but you could never tell. Jean is afraid. Stay back, don't touch me. And Angel yells, you heard the lady, back off. A balding guy says, what's the matter, girly? Real humans not good enough for you? Immediately to the sexist words, right? Girly and not good enough. Same to you. We don't want your kind around here. Phil thinks they were criminals, killers. And someone yells, stinking beauties. We moved in. There was a chunk of brick in my hand. And he finds himself throwing the brick. Again, groupthink. And it pops a 16-year-old boy who's covered in ice right in the head. Ouch, yells Bobby as a brick strikes him. Why, you miserable, Cyclops says. Iceman, don't. Forget about him. They're not worth it. And the X-Men escape through a hole in the wall. Cyclops blasts it. They get out of there. Phil thinks, like a summer squall, it ended quickly. The one they called Cyclops blasted a hole in the wall and they vanished into the shadows. The crowd dispersed, but his words stayed with me. They're not worth it. Not worth it. What did he mean by it? Again, we're going to take this to modern times. Trump can say fucking every insult about everyone ever, but Hillary Clinton says the phrase basket of deplorables one time, and it's the one thing they latch on. Look what they're saying about us. How could they do that? Brilliantly captured, brilliantly written.
Your check, your cooperative. As a farmer-owned lender, Farm Credit Mid-America shares the success of the cooperative with our customers, which is why we've returned more than $1.5 billion back to our customer owners over the last 9 years. It's proof being a part of our cooperative pays. Patronage is an annual decision made by the board of directors to return earnings to eligible customers. To learn more about patronage and eligibility, visit fcma.com/patronage.
This podcast is supported by Talkspace.
When my husband came home from his military deployment, readjusting was hard for all of us. Thankfully, I found Talkspace.
Talkspace provides professional support from licensed therapists and psychiatric providers online. Military members, veterans, and their dependents ages 13 and older can get fast access to providers, all from the privacy of their computers or smartphones.
I just answered a few questions online, and Talkspace matched me with a therapist. We meet when it's convenient for me, and I can message her anytime. It was so easy to set up, and they accept TRICARE. Therapy was going so well, my husband and I started seeing a couples therapist through Talkspace, too.
Talkspace works with most major insurers, including TRICARE. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com/military. Go to Talkspace.com/military to get started today. That's Talkspace.com/military.
I mean, the art direction and is just such a very, very smart move from Alex, or I mean, maybe her, him and Kurt worked on it together, but to use Cyclops's red to, you know, have them aside from the colors of New York City. I mean, already Alex Ross has made this like absolutely gorgeous idyllic scene of like the warmth coming from Janet's collection windows out at, you know, at dusk. You know, it's a very beautiful rendition of New York City with this dramatic, gorgeous lighting, but then take the colors of the X-Men, which are their, you know, truly Cyclops's colors. Like he is emanating this really bright red, but he never really bathes everybody in that red tone the way that they chose to do here, which was just so smart because it makes them threatening and dramatic and othering them from the colors of the scene.
Even in the single image where Phil's looking at his camera, that frightening image of Scott, we've got the Wasp like brightly lit on the left, all the costumes with that like dark tunnel the X-Men had to run into on the right. On the way home, I wondered why I did what I did. I was a newsman. I didn't make the news. I observed it. At least I usually did, but there was something about the mutants. They were the dark side of the Marvels, where Captain America and Mr. Fantastic spoke to us about the greatness within us all. The mutants were death. They didn't even do anything. They were our replacements, scientists said. The next evolutionary step. We, Homo sapiens, were obsolete, and they were the future. They were going to kick the dirt onto our graves. Again, Cyclops, they're not worth it. Just playing over and over in his brain. It was a terrifying thought. Well, obsolete or not, we weren't going out without a fight. And again, we look at this in the modern era, and after this election, it's really uncomfortable. Not when we had so much to protect. And here we go, Phil. He rides the subway back to his little suburb house where he walks in on his two cute little daughters, and they are playing superhero inside. This is Jenny and Beth. We get to see them grow up a little bit as the book goes on. They're fighting about who's cool and who's not. Spider-Man is icky. I don't want to be the eel. I'm in a Hulk. I'm so strong. And Phil says, as he's watching his daughters play, I didn't ask if they ever played the X-Men. His wife walks up. She is kind of checking on him, and he seems worried. What's wrong, honey? She says. What was I going to say? That I was scared mutants would enslave our daughters? The word enslave, remember that for just a minute from now. And she's like, oh, please, everything's going to be fine. Then we go back into his dark room where the world is bathed in red. He's developing images of that burning form in the sky, of Cyclops's red visor. In a way, the mutants were worse than the supervillains, he thinks. The eel? He was just a man in a suit. I have a Patreon on the eel. Go check it out. It's really interesting. Dangerous, sure, but the torch would stop him, would protect us. Who would protect us from the mutants? I had to wonder, were the mutants the price we paid for the Marvels? The negatives without which the pictures we wanted couldn't exist. Tyson, thoughts? This is like sheer fucking poetry right here.
We're going back to that same red light. Right. And I think that this is a really great use of color in the sense that when we saw this stark red just a few pages prior, it was in a moment of fear. It was in a moment of desperation. And where is Phil internally currently? He is in fear. He is in desperation. So we're using that dark red, that very vibrant, almost violent hue of red to show Phil's internal struggle, which is only matched by the words that we're reading in these panels as well. So incredibly smart way to kind of insist upon an energy and a feeling that Phil might be having currently.
Yeah, the weapons designer celebrated. The guy calling himself a god celebrated. The guy literally lighting the sky on fire celebrated. But this teenager with the red eyes is the thing he's afraid of. And all he has to protect, right? The daughter, his daughters, like their virtue, the future of his children, what's at stake? His idea of the mutants as the dark side, they're even worse than the supervillains. I can understand the supervillains. Who the fuck are these queers? Who the fuck are these people of color? Who the fuck are these people I don't understand that aren't part of my American world, right? Like, that's very clearly the subtext. Next page, he's back on the train. He's riding into the city in the daylight. They get to catch an image of Thor flying over, and he's very excited about his book, his pictures. We see a newspaper headline with his shot of Giant Man on it, and the announcement, Avengers Route, Masters of Evil. They're patting him on the back. Everything is great. Everybody's super excited. And then he gets to go to a big swanky party. Alicia Masters, who's a blind sculptress, has designed images, statues, marble carvings of some of the world's biggest superheroes and supervillains. We see the Hulk. We see Dr. Doom. We see Atuma. We see the Submariner. He gets to take pictures. It's all swanky. And we see a lot of our characters interacting here. We see Johnny Storm with Dory Evans. We see Reed and Sue. We see some of our favorite characters like Doctor Strange in the background. Norman Osborn is in one panel. You have to kind of look, but you could see all these different characters interacting in the universe.
Maybe
B. Arthur? I would love it if B. Arthur was there. We see Tony Stark looking very Howard Hughes, flirting with some people. And it's just this big swanky party and everything is fine. There's an image of the Hulk and that's fine. There's an image of the Thing that's fine. They turn and see the Thing and a couple of old women go, at least he's not one of those horrible muties. Meanwhile, Professor X...
Scott B. Arthur would never say that.
Yeah, that's true. If that is B. Arthur, she would not have said that. But as she's commenting on this, we see Professor X, Scott, and Jean looking over at her with angry eyes. Again, they're blending in right in plain sight. And then Phil steps outside very quickly. He says, I took about 60 shots and had a brief chat with the sculptress. Amazing that a blind woman could do work like that from just physical descriptions. But she'd certainly chosen the right subjects. That much was clear from the exhibit. If even the Thing was accepted by the public. And then as he goes outside, he sees in bright red letters painted on the wall, mutants die bloody. And he thinks, what a city. Derek, what are your thoughts on the contrast once again emphasized here?
I guess as a general thought about this whole issue, so maybe this is kind of a closing thought, so I'll keep it brief. But like, if Alicia Masters, who's blind and can do all this, like thought of being like passable as a mutant, like why doesn't the thought go to like, what, she might have some weird ability that, you know, why isn't the target on her, right? It just seemed something that was really a major theme for me in this whole issue was that the thought of like passable, and he does talk about that too. I mean, I don't have too much to say about that, but it was just something like, who gets to be celebrated and who doesn't?
I mean, go back to the 1960s or McCarthyism, right? Like these certain things are really shamed. If you are a white person associating with a black person who wants equal rights, like we will kill you and the courts will let us go, right? That's very much the image, where other things are widely ignored. War crimes, fucking Kissinger is alive during this time and being absolutely celebrated, right? It just depends on who you know.
He says here, she chose the right subjects, and Dr. Doom is one of the right subjects.
Yeah.
So it's clear that there, I mean, I think the biggest thing is it's so evident in the, I mean, I wouldn't even say subtext, it's so clear that it's, everyone is telling you the mutants are bad, so they're clearly bad, because I was told.
The police can use guns on certain people, and that's okay, but on other people it's completely unacceptable, right? It depends on who's pulling the trigger and who they're pointing it at first. As Phil rides away, what a city, from the heights to the depths in moments. That was the nature of the place. At least in the suburbs it was different. We didn't have the Marvels and we didn't have the mutant scare either. Out here we were away from it, we were safe. Nope, not so much. Turns out diversity is everywhere you go. So he's at dinner, the kids are giggling because they have a little dog that they're keeping in the basement, the parents think, and they're like, oh, they're so cute. We jump back again the next day to a very public reception where Reed and Sue are announcing they're getting married, and the whole fucking city is celebrating. There are wedding specials. They're on the cover of Life and 17 and Red Book. There's huge public engagement parties. Everything is in the light. J. Jonah Jameson is smoking in public and nobody cares. But again, you turn around, red print on the wall, muties out, kill all mutants. Very, very scary. The next day, we see Captain America announcing a new lineup of Avengers. And again, I'm skipping over a bunch of Easter eggs here, but there's some great ones. But we see Scarlet Witch, Quicksilver, and Hawkeye as the new kooky quartet of the Avengers. Scarlet Witch and Quicksilver are mutant terrorists at this point. They've been working with Magneto. They took over a country. They lived in space. But suddenly Captain America is vouching for them and everything is okay. We see Daredevil in an image. We see a newspaper headline about Sue Storm being kidnapped by the Frightful Four. And then things start to get scary in the suburbs as well.
Well, I mean, just as a little aside, I'm so intrigued as a very distraction of all of the references that Alex Ross must use for these characters. I swear Mr. Fantastic is the professor from Gilligan's Island.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I even pulled up Google just to kind of like compare it. I don't think it's like a one for one, but I really think that's his inspiration. But so many people in this, I think, are inspired by real people. Like, I think Alicia Masters is Susan Day. People that, like, I've been trying to figure out who Johnny is too, because he's got such a specific look of a character at the time. And I love it because, you know, these people feel so much more real for it, for the, like, the fact he's tracking it. And the Fantastic Four are, to me, have always been kind of bland and generic. I've never really been that interested in them as, but he grounds them in these like kind of local celebrities and uses celebrities to frame them in this as well and make them look glamorous and make them look important and cover ready. And they are, like, they're on every cover of every magazine and celebrate. celebrated because they look like celebrities. And I think that's just really smart and just beautiful art as well.
Now, I'm going to just dose this with heaviness for just a second. Everyone from a disenfranchised population know what it's like to not feel safe. We automatically just assume, unless it's a big city, that you're not safe. If you go anywhere rural, they're going to pull out the torches and kill the beast. They're going to grab the pitchforks and chase you down. They're going to pull out the handgun and say, call the cops, get you out of here. And that energy for trans people in our country today, for Black people in our country today, for people who are of different ethnicities, for gay people, it's very real. It's very alive. And there's a reason we grieve. But here we go, because this is every X-Men comic ever, right? Phil gets back home. All the neighbors are upset because someone saw a child with the face of a skull over by a trash can. Who knows what it was up to? Grab your guns. Grab your pitchforks. There's literally pitchforks in the crowd. We got to go find them. We got to find it. Look toward the park. There's a mutant here. Phil goes sprinting for home. Mutants here? It wasn't fair. We worked so hard to give our families a good life, to keep them safe. It wasn't fair. And when he gets home, his daughters are panicking. Don't let them hurt her. It turns out they weren't keeping a spare dog or a stray dog in the basement. They are keeping a homeless child in the basement. There's a little girl named Maggie, and she has a huge cranium and big black eyes. She looks like an alien. She is against the wall in the shadows with some food scraps sitting around her, bows in her hair, and she is so scared. She's hiding down there in the dark. Phil's immediate reaction is fear. I couldn't think. Was it contagious? It, right? Was it contagious? If the girls had touched it, if they'd been infected somehow. And they say, we found her in the park after the storm. She was wet. And the little girl speaks up. I was hungry, mister, or I'd have kept hiding. Daddy got fired out of his work. Mama cried all the time. They said they couldn't take care of me anymore, that it was all my fault. They went away. And Phil thinks, they were evil, the mutants. They wanted to kill us all. Everybody knew that. And the little girl starts crying. Are you going to send me away? They say, she's nice, Daddy. She played with us. Phil knows the neighbors are running outside. They know, he knows that if they know he has a mutant in his house, they will burn his house to the ground. And the first thing he thinks of, here's the flashback. They were scared. I was scared. But there was something in her, in its eyes, and I couldn't help thinking of the liberation of Auschwitz and the look in their eyes. Mm. We see an image, and again, this is the Magneto story. We see an image of the emaciated people leaving Auschwitz, very few survivors. And he says, dear God, Doris, she's just a little girl. Really, really powerful. Seth, do you have thoughts on this scene and the way the art is portrayed?
You know, it's really appropriate. It's like a single bulb and, you know, she's on a garage floor in squalor with like tiny bits of candy because little girls have fed her. So it's like they brought her candy to eat. I mean, it's
that donut on the ground. Yeah.
It's really sad. And it's really, you know, just a huge purposeful disconnect from these, you know, blue sky framed superheroes that, you know, are not hiding in the darkness amongst cardboard boxes and, you know, just open outlets, you know. And it's, I think, also just a really intimate scene for him with, you know, coming to terms of his, you know, face to face with something in a very small, tight space that is what he's been so scared of all this time. And she's not frightening at all, but just sad.
So it doesn't take time to explore this widely, but the parallel here, if you go back to pre-war in Germany, is the Nazi party is putting out all sorts of things about how evil Jews are, how they will harm your children. They are rats. They are vermin. Don't touch them. And he is making the choice in like a very kind of Diary of Anne Frank way to let this mutant child hide in his basement because they'll kill her if he lets her out, but they'll come after his family if they know. So there's this kind of wrong side of history, right side of history energy. The channeling of this is really powerful. So he lets the girl stay in the basement. He goes back into the city and he immediately says, like, I need help looking for my stuff. The news media is obsessed with this wedding. We got the menu for the wedding. It's the full menu for the reception, down to the melon balls. This guy's so fucking excited. Phil takes himself over to the library, but it wasn't much help. Aside from the scientific stuff, there were reports of the X-Men freeing a military base from Magneto, protecting defense secrets. That's the Vanisher story. Even attending an engagement party at the Baxter building. On the other hand, and here's where we get and this is from the original Stan Lee Jack Kirby first Sentinels appearance, we get Oliver Trask, mutant menace in the newspapers, and we get this image of mutant overlords enslaving mankind to do their bidding. They're going to take our place, he says. And these are literal images. Kid Omega draws upon these later.
The internal struggle that Phil is almost certainly dealing with is being shown in real life on the newspapers that everybody else in his world are reading. It sort of solidifies his fear of the mutants, because why would you not believe what everybody else is is reading, right? The perception is reality, I think, is the same. Yet just a few pages later, we see that he's continuing to harbor this person.
Yeah, so
the internal struggle's on full display.
So back at home, he's watching his girls play with this child. He's conflicted. Upstairs, he picks up the phone. It's the communist thing. Hello. I was just wondering, does the FBI have any pamphlets on mutants or anything? What should the general public do? The voice on the other line says, if you have a mutant sighting to report, sir, we'll have a team of agents sent out right away. Oh, no, thank you. And he just hangs up. There were reports of the X-Men were seen frequently in Greenwich Village. I thought if I could find him, maybe they could take her. Like, my family won't be in danger. I started spending evenings down there. And sure enough, because the X-Men hang out at the Cafe Agogo, right? We see Iceman and Beast jump giant fucking feet. They're jumping around. And he is afraid of them. He again remembers Cyclops, that red visor. They're not worth it. He thinks, what if they remembered me? This is the kid he hit with a brick, right? We then go to a Fantastic Four club party. Everybody's preparing for the wedding. Everybody's coming to the wedding. And we get a giant panel. And this is right from the original Fantastic Four run of all the heroes in the Marvel Universe attending the wedding. Now, some of the X-Men were there. The Quicksilver and the Scarlet Witch are in like row three. The X-Men are tucked somewhere in the background. And we get this image of Reed and Sue kissing while the thing weeps nearby. And Johnny is smiling.
It's another like celebration of just, you know, the Marvel Universe at that time. And it just seems incredibly wholesome. And it's, you know, this kind of is in parallel of like, you know, a royal wedding, the same like excitement around it all. So yeah, I think it's like, it would be like the same gravitas as something like that.
After this giant celebration, Phil joins a bunch of reporters, including J. Jonah Jameson, over at a kind of dingy bar where there's some old headlines celebrating old superheroes, the All Winners Squad. And on the television, there's a debate between Bolivar Trask and some egghead name of Xavier. He says, we're all off base about the muties. They're just fluffy little bunnies who want to make nice with us. Bah! And we get to see on the news the debate turn very quickly into Bolivar Trask announcing the very frightening Sentinels. The Sentinels turn on Trask, they blast him, and the station shuts down. J. Jonah Jameson calls one of his reporters Foswell. Now, this is a really obscure Spider-Man villain called the Big Man. Freddy Foswell is a 60s super. Foswell, get over there. We got to go report on this. Sheldon is like really reflecting on, holy shit, there's another story happening here. Everybody's scared. Like, what's going to happen here? And outside, there's an anti-mutant mob. We saw these newspaper headlines. We see the Sentinels. And now everybody is turning on who they assume is a mutant in the street. He looks different. Let's get him. Bricks are being thrown. Fire is being set. Now, there's a very huge difference between a mob of people who are attacking the disenfranchised and something like Stonewall, where the disenfranchisers are standing back, right? What we allow is culturally acceptable. It's okay for us to come after you, but you can't defend yourself is part of the energy here. People are scared and they're just destroying shit. And Phil's taking photos of the glasses breaking, the cars on fire, civilians hurt or even murdered. There's a bloody body on the ground of a black man. It like clearly bleeding from the abdomen. The streets are on fire. The fervor is there. Phil's trying to help a woman escape from an injury. And then it was only fitting that the Sentinels ended it. After all, they'd been the ones to finally touch it off. Gorgeous, iconic image. The cover art for today's episode.
It has a very, honestly, like a propaganda-esque look, Sentinels. Interestingly, I can't quite tell the spin of this. Like, the Sentinels end it, but I don't know, they're terrifying. You know, they look like drones that are going to, they could turn on you at any time, as they clearly did. I don't understand quite how they've calmed here, because I wouldn't feel any better seeing them.
They must have been scanning for mutants to capture or something, but the light, it made us look around, made us see. And then we were thinking, and we were just people again, people in a street full of broken glass.
When I remember when I first read this book, that particular page reminded me of, if everybody, I'm sure we all know, The Rocketeer. So there's a moment in that film when we see the Nazis' idea. They have like a short sort of proof of concept that they're trying to sell of the jetpack troopers. And it is incredibly menacing, but also sort of awe-inspiring at the same time.
Everyone is so fucking scared. The subway is just getting everybody out of the city as fast as possible. Trask fucking did this, right? Like, this is what happens when we turn the lens of the camera in a different direction. Over in the X-Men book, they're fighting the Sentinels. And this is where Xavier finds that weird crystal that like disrupts their energy. Don't worry about it. I love that story. Sheldon rushes home. He's worried is my house going to be on fire? What about the kids? What happened to that little girl? The daughters are in the arms of Doris, and she hands up a little note that's written in little kid writing in green letters. Dear Mr. Sheldon, thank you for everything, but I have to leave. I do not want your Y-O-U-R-E family to get hurt because B-E-C-O-S-E, because of me. I took some food, some is S-O-M. Thank you for the new clothes. Love, Maggie. She left. She was out there alone on this of all nights, and we would never know what happened to her. Now, he's very quickly realizing, holy shit, the Fantastic Four just got married this afternoon, and now this is happening in the city. Look at how quickly it all shifts. Work has to go on. He's got to write his article. He's got to write the chatty atmosphere stuff, he says. I got to capture all the magic and joy. The newspaper's not going to wait. I got to get this in now. But his daughter walks in. Daddy, is Maggie going to be all right? I wanted more than anything to tell her everything would be fine, that there was a happy ending. And he says, I don't know, Jenny. And meanwhile, the news moves on. Iron Man's fighting Titanium Man in a match tomorrow on Sunday. Come check it out. He says, I hope so. I hope it's going to be okay. And that's where the story ends.
The place where I'm from, actually, in New York, is the birthplace of Rod Serling. He created the Twilight Zone. So this is a very like Twilight Zone-esque issue, especially when everybody starts freaking out and like hitting each other. Rod liked to really like play off on like just humanity and how it could go wrong and bad. So there's really like a big parallel to that, to something like, you know, he was from my hometown, so we always celebrated the Twilight Zone. And then at the end, there's not really a sense of closure either. So it makes you really like think like you're feeling for Maggie, like you're really concerned.
Yeah. Maggie comes back. Does anyone know this? Less familiar. There's a sequel to this series called Marvel's Eye of the Camera. I'll have to do a Patreon on Phil Sheldon someday. It's very Schindler's List. We get to learn what happened to Maggie. She got out of the city. She snuck aboard a plane. And now in her older years, she basically comes back to the deathbed of Phil Sheldon and says like, thank you. You saved me when I was a child. It's very like Oscar Schindler. Go read it. We're not going to cover it today, but it's beautiful. Issue 3 of this limited series jumps into Acts of God. It's Galactus coming down to Earth and the literal world being on fire and Phil feeling so small in conjunction. And in issue 4, it ends in the early 70s where Phil is reckoning with the idea of the world is more complicated than we always thought it was. We have people of color. We have Vision and the Scarlet Witches, the interracial romance that everybody's so upset about. We have black superheroes. We have corrupt government ideas. And he gets to meet and be enchanted by Gwen Stacy, who dies at the end. And Norman Osborn dies as well. And Spider-Man is this guy that I don't really get. He's also kind of creepy. What do we do with this? Every issue of this series is fucking beautiful. This is a really powerful issue. And it's an incredible appearance of the X-Men and what they represented in the Silver Age.
Yeah, I made 2 notes, actually, that really stuck with me through this. And they both, of course, have to do with the art. If you really follow Phil's eye, he only has one eye and it's blue. An incredible stage direction. You follow what he's feeling in that singular eye. It tracks everything you're supposed to, as a reader, be picking up, and every emotion he's getting. You know, it's of course subjective, but it's, you know, it's the storytelling, and it's really beautiful and incredibly, like, his eyes focus and get they're just so emotive and expressive. And I think it's interesting because that is, like you said before, like his myopic understanding of the world, but it tells the story back to the reader. And then the second part that kind of goes along with it are all the lenses and reflections. You see the different views reflected back in the glasses and in the camera lens and car windshields, and they're so beautiful and such smart storytelling. And then finally, from the little girl's eyes back of Phil, they're just so, I just love that very quiet storytelling that is not with words, just like as like you kind of absorb it as it goes, and it's not always in the very first read that you get it. I think that this series and this, both Kurt and Alex, just do such a beautiful job of such a layered storytelling in this book.
Yeah, I think something that stands out for me in this run, all 4 books, not just this particular book 2, but is the use of color to convey emotion. And I know I've talked about this throughout this episode, but it really is, from page to page, the overall tone of Phil's emotion set what tone of color we're looking at. If it's the softer hues of yellow, it might be feelings of hope or of friendship or of family. If it's these dark, vibrant hues of red, he is scared, he's worried, he's frightened, all of these fearful emotions. When we see these bright whites and blues, these are moments of hope and moments of great spectacle. So the use of color on the behalf of Alex Ross is impeccable.
I enjoyed how this story, I guess enjoy is not the right word.
It's fucking great. You can enjoy it. It's good.
Yeah.
I'm going to start talking about Trump. And I'm thinking like context, putting it in the context of our current climate. Like I look at Phil and like something I personally have been struggling with lately is like, why is it so hard? I can't teach empathy and I can't teach to really take care of each other, take care of people's feelings. And you see Phil, he's questioning and then he has the mob mentality and then he actually meets a mutant and then he starts learning and his children start teaching, like the children don't have hate in them. Like, so he's on this path to like acceptance and hopefully more than tolerance, but I'm struggling talking about it because I'm still trying to figure out my own personal feelings after after the election, but like, it's something that I wish more people would go through, but I also wish that they wouldn't have to meet somebody that is in a marginalized group to make these like try to start on this path to learning. So that's not a really eloquent way to say it, but it's just I think somebody who could identify with being somebody like Phil, it might be a story that they could resonate more with.
Some of the themes captured here are not subtle, and they're captured so often in other places. The newspaper headlines and how they tell us what we should celebrate and how culture dictates what's okay. The ease with which people turn toward violence, toward things that they don't understand. The comparison between the innocence of Phil's children and how he's only worried for their safety because they've associated with someone else, right? But what about Maggie's safety? What about the other children? What about the trans kids? What about the people out there who have been... this is where we can't get really dark, but like the kids in cages at the border, like, is that thing that just keeps popping up in my brain again. We are celebrating the deaths of some children while restricting people's ability to make choices about their own futures and what we deem acceptable versus what we don't deem acceptable. Yeah, the X-Men are going to be resonant in these next 4 years in this country, y'all. And this is a book from 1994 about life in the 1960s being read from times in the 2020s where the themes are still very, very resonant. This is a special story. It's really beautiful. If you have never read Marvels, please, please go read it. I loved nerding out with all of you today and having this conversation. Does anything kind of stick with you? Are there any unanswered questions or just any final thoughts you have on the portrayal of this book, which, reminder, is titled Monsters?
Maybe not a final hope, but more to the point of the whole use of color and light. The very last page, when we look at the very last page, the last things that we see as far as a speech bubble are Phil's words, "I hope so." And what are we looking at? We're looking at an incredibly dark exterior. So we're talking about blackness, darkness, symbolizing fear and uncertainty. But what's in the background of that? This light that's on in the back of his home, where his family, where his heart is, representing hope. So an example of the words on the page meeting the visual insinuation perfectly. That light in his home is Phil's heart and his hope, which is shining through the darkness, his uncertainty, and his fear.
And his family's allowed to be safe because a child went off on her own.
There you go.
Yeah, it's rough. As we're wrapping up, where can people find each of you online? Is there anything you want to plug at the end of 2024? Thank you, everybody, for listening. This is a beautiful issue. And in a surprising way, like kind of the perfect way to recap what we've been trying to create on this show from the very beginning. Grey Malkin Lane has always been meant to be about the concept of found family, about finding ourselves and safety and giving voice to those ideas that we don't often see. We have a history of comics told by incredible creators, some of it problematic and that we have to reclaim, but some of it really beautiful. And the X-Men have always represented the flip side of that. The contrast between the X-Men and mutants and the Fantastic Four and the Avengers is fascinating. And we put this in the political landscape of, as we release this in the coming year, we're going to have a major shift in American politics once again. And we're going to find our stories here in the way that we always have. At the beginning of 2025, Grey Malkin Lane has has a new logo. We've got a new mission statement a little bit. The stories move from one age into another, and we've been building all through that in 2024. But I'm really excited about the complexity of the content we're introducing as we shift into a new age of complex storytelling and frankly, overwhelming storytelling. I could spend probably 5 years just doing books from the 70s before we even get to like 1982. God Loves, Man Kills, I think, is the next major shift after this, when we start to like solidify the tone even more. But can't wait for new characters. Storm, Nightcrawler, Thunderbird, Krakoa, Colossus. We get to start having big conversations in the new year. What a great, amazing fucking joy this last 3.5 years has been with you all. And I can't wait to continue in the new year.
Oh my gosh. So I would say if you haven't read the Marvels, this is a great book to read. If you also would like to read something not nearly as dark as this, but just a spooky supernatural book, my graphic novel, The Mare, is out and you can buy it anywhere books are sold. Or if you like to see my artwork, I will be drawing the new logo for the show. So that will be coming out this year or this coming year. Otherwise, you can follow me on SC Martell on Instagram or SethChristianMartell.com.
I don't really have much to plug, but you can follow me. I'm just goofing off on Instagram usually. My handle is Derek J. Nichols. My day job pertains to sustainability and climate change. So I focus on climate change, especially through the lens of a queer person. So I will plug an account that's not mine, but I think more pie should be on it. It's Queers for Climate Justice, just so we're all informed on how climate change does have an impact on our community if you're part of it. But yeah, happy to meet other nerds and geek out over this stuff.
Yeah.
Thanks, Derek. And Tyson?
You can find me on Instagram and Facebook at my name, Tyson Leetz. That's spelled T-Y-S-O-N-L-I-E-T-Z. Lots of cosplay, nerdy fun on both of those. If you want to see any of my acting work, you can find me on my IMDb page. That'll lead you a lot of the films that I've participated in. Also just Tyson Leetz at IMDb. It was a joy being here. Super fun.
Loved hanging out with you. Can't wait to do it again. Lastly, yeah. I'm Chad Anderson. I keep my own social media private because I got kiddos. The three of you are welcome to add me. I am going to get extraordinarily sentimental for just a minute. Making this show has changed my whole fucking life. Really, truly. I've always been a creative person, but to have a place to pour that energy and the establishment of community through this show has made just an extraordinary difference for this like little lonely kid that grew up not knowing anybody and not feeling seen. I'm super grateful to all of you. I'm especially grateful and sorry in advance to my very best friend, Seth Martell, who has made such a difference in my life. Through this show, we became friends. I'm extraordinarily grateful for you regularly, but for everyone that I have befriended through the show, people who come on the show again and again and again, people who listen and interact, it has made just an extraordinary difference. I can't wait to launch into the new year with you all. Thank you, thank you, thank you. We're ending the show this year with the trial of Scott Summers, which I know you've all been waiting for.
Yeah.
Very long time. We're launching into the new year with a massive script reading of Giant Size X-Men number one, a celebration of the life of Len Wein, and then building toward a title we're calling Conversations About Krakoa, where we get to reflect on the Krakoan era of comics. All that's just in January, along with our regular programming. So thank you everyone for listening. Thank you all for the incredible ongoing support. What a beautiful way to end 2024. And we'll see you on the other side, y'all. We'll see you back here next time on Gray Malkin Lane. Thank you for listening to Gray Malkin Lane. We hope you are enjoying this podcast. Gray Malkin Lane is produced and recorded in Salt Lake City, Utah, with music and editing done by my husband, Michael Bell, and promo art done by the incredible Seth Martell. Look for us on Patreon, where we are releasing weekly episodes about obscure characters and facts. It's a great way to participate with the podcast for only just a couple of dollars a month, and it helps support what we are doing here. Also, the best way you could help Gray Malkin Lane is by sharing and liking and subscribing, but also please leave us a review wherever you listen to your podcasts. We'll see you back here next time on Gray Malkin Lane.
Your check, your cooperative. As a farmer-owned lender, Farm Credit Mid-America shares the success of the cooperative with our customers, which is why we've returned more than $1.5 billion back to our customer owners over the last 9 years. It's proof being a part of our cooperative pays. Patronage is an annual decision made by the board of directors to return earnings to eligible customers. To learn more about patronage and eligibility, visit fcma.com/patronage.
This podcast is supported by Talkspace.
When my husband came home from his military deployment, readjusting was hard for all of us. Thankfully, I found Talkspace.
Talkspace provides professional support from licensed therapists and psychiatric providers online. Military members, veterans, and their dependents ages 13 and older can get fast access to providers, all from the privacy of their computers or smartphones.
I just answered a few questions online, and Talkspace matched me with a therapist. We meet when it's convenient for me, and I can message her anytime. It was so easy to set up, and they accept TRICARE. Therapy was going so well, my husband and I started seeing a couples therapist through Talkspace, too.
Talkspace works with most major insurers, including TRICARE. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com/military. Go to Talkspace.com/military to get started today. That's Talkspace.com/military.